Imagine, just for a second, the sudden, like, violent jolt of a collision.
Right. It's terrifying.
Yeah. The screech of tires, the breaking of glass, the absolute chaos of the moment. And then, as you're just trying to process what in the world just happened, you look up.
And you watch the driver who caused it all just, well, step on the gas.
Exactly. They just vanish down the street. So today on the Deep Dive, we are taking a really hard look at this terrifying epidemic of hit-and-run crashes.
It's an epidemic that really demands our attention.
It does, because, I mean, we're pulling from urban traffic data, behavioral psychology studies regarding human flight response, and, crucially, the actual case files and legal strategies from top-tier New York personal injury litigators.
Which is so important because, this fundamentally breaks the social contract that we all rely on just to step out our front doors every day.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And our mission today is to really uncover the underlying mechanics of this danger, specifically across the NYC and Westchester County areas. We're going to explore the cognitive psychology behind why drivers actually run. We'll break down the exact step-by-step actions you need to take to survive the immediate aftermath.
Because that aftermath is just pure chaos if you aren't prepared.
Exactly. And we'll reveal the hidden legal mechanisms that victims use to actually fight back and secure their futures. And we are anchoring this whole discussion around a truly heartbreaking real-world event.
Yeah, the July 17, 2026 incident.
Right. A hit and run in East New York, Brooklyn, where a 6-year-old boy was struck and just left seriously injured by a fleeing driver.
It's just devastating. And when you look at the raw data surrounding an incident like that, it really forces you to reevaluate how we interact with our environment.
I agree completely. Like, I've been thinking a lot about the layout of our region lately.
Hey, what's up?
Well, the roadways across NYC and Westchester places, like the Cross Bronx Expressway, the Major Deegan, the Hutchinson River Parkway, Interstate 287.
Right, the major arteries.
Exactly. They operate literally like the region's bloodstream. They are designed for this continuous, high-volume flow of traffic.
But there's a big catch there.
Right, because unlike a closed biological system, these arteries are high-pressure friction zones.
That is a really great way to put it, friction zone.
Yeah, you have, thousands of pounds of heavy metal moving at high velocities, and they are constantly intersecting with completely unprotected pedestrians.
That fluid dynamics analogy is, it's spot on. Because when you design a system prioritizing the rapid movement of rigid, heavy objects,
Cars and trucks.
exactly, any biological obstacle, introduced to that flow is going to suffer catastrophic damage. And I think it's important to note this isn't just an East New York problem.
Oh, not at all.
The traffic data shows this is a really pervasive systemic reality. You see these dangerous friction points extending like all the way up through White Plains and Yonkers
Right.
and heavily throughout the Bronx, Queens, Manhattan, and really any local neighborhood where high pedestrian density just meets impatient commuters.
So let's get into the minds of those drivers, because I honestly struggle to understand the mechanism of that decision.
It's hard to wrap your head around for sure.
It is, because human empathy, basic human instinct, should be to slam on the brakes, jump out, and help the 6-year-old you just hit.
Absolutely.
What is the cognitive process that just overrides that instinct and makes a person hit the gas instead?
What's fascinating here is that the behavioral psychology research we reviewed points directly to something called an amygdala hijack.
An amygdala hijack. Wait, what does that actually mean?
So, in a moment of extreme trauma or stress, the brain's rational processing center, the prefrontal cortex, essentially just shuts down.
Okay.
And the primitive part of the brain takes over, and it triggers a pure, unfiltered fight or flight response.
So you're saying they aren't even thinking logically? It's just like animal panic.
In the first few seconds, yes, the rational brain is offline. But the data reveals it's usually more calculated than just blind panic once they get down the block.
Oh, interesting. How so?
Well, it's a compounding of bad decisions. Leaving the scene of an injury accident is a serious criminal offense in New York. You are legally mandated to stop and render aid.
Right, obviously.
But the people who flee are overwhelmingly operating outside the law already before the crash even happens.
Ah, I see.
The psychological matrix includes drivers who are, say, under the influence of alcohol or drugs, individuals driving without insurance, or people operating with a suspended or revoked license.
So they are essentially doing this rapid on-the-fly risk assessment.
Precisely. They might have outstanding warrants,
Yeah.
So in a fraction of a second, their brain calculates, if I wait for the police, I am definitely going to jail for X, Y, or Z.
But if I run, I might get away with it.
Exactly. But here is the really critical physiological impact of that choice. Regardless of whether they are running because of a DUI or just sheer terror, the act of fleeing fundamentally changes the medical outcome for the victim.
Right, because of the time delay. I mean, we always hear about the golden hour in trauma medicine.
Exactly. In severe blunt force trauma, particularly with internal bleeding, survival isn't measured in hours. It's measured in minutes.
Wow. That really puts it in perspective.
Yeah. By leaving the scene, the driver delays the dispatch of emergency medical services. They aren't just fleeing a location. They are actively stealing the most critical window of medical intervention from that child.
That makes the reality of navigating these, like, friction zones terrifying, especially when we talk about children.
It really is.
Because the developmental data in our sources really opened my eyes. We always say kids are at risk because they are small, right?
Right. They're physically harder to see over the hood of a massive SUV.
Yeah, but it's way deeper than just their height, isn't it?
Oh, much deeper. The cognitive science shows that children literally do not process visual and auditory data the same way adults do.
Really? Like their actual senses work differently.
Yes. Their peripheral vision is underdeveloped, meaning they have a much narrower field of view. Mm. Furthermore, they struggle with auditory localization.
Okay, break that down for me. Auditory localization.
It means figuring out where a sound is coming from. If an adult hears a siren or a revving engine, our brain instantly calculates where that sound is originating.
Right. I know if a car is coming from my left or right.
Exactly. But a young child hears the noise, but often cannot pinpoint the direction of the threat quickly enough.
Wow. And what about speed? Because I remember reading that kids essentially can't tell how fast a car is moving.
That's totally correct. Judging velocity requires complex neural pathways that calculate the rate at which an object is expanding in your field of vision.
And kids just don't have that yet.
Right. Children haven't fully developed that neural hardware. They might see a car a block away, but their brain tells them it's safe to cross because they literally cannot accurately calculate that the car is doing 50 miles per hour in a 25 mile per hour zone.
Okay, well, I have to push back here for a second.
Go ahead.
Because knowing all of this cognitive science, parents are told to drill a very specific safety curriculum into their kids.
The look both ways rules.
Exactly. We tell them to cross only at the marked crosswalks, wait for the pedestrian signal, make physical eye contact with the driver before you step off the curb.
Put the phone away.
Right. Never assume the car is going to stop. I mean, we do this exhaustively. So are you telling me that a child can execute that checklist perfectly, follow every single rule, and still get hit?
It is honestly the most frustrating reality of urban planning and traffic safety. But yes, I have to validate that fear.
That is just terrifying.
You can program a child to be a perfect pedestrian, but the negligent driver remains an uncontrollable wild card.
It feels like the entire burden of safety is completely unbalanced. Like it's all on the person walking.
It is unbalanced by design, unfortunately. The physics of a 2-ton machine moving at speed dictate that the ultimate burden of safety really must fall on the operator of that machine.
Yeah, that makes sense.
When a driver is distracted by a text message, driving under the influence, or treating a residential street in Yonkers like a drag strip,
pedestrian perfection just isn't enough.
Exactly. It isn't enough to stop physics. This is why residential neighborhoods, school zones, and playgrounds demand absolute hypervigilant alertness from motorists.
So knowing that the wild card exists completely changes the paradigm. We can't just rely on prevention. We have to prepare for the aftermath.
We do.
I want you, the listener, right now to really imagine being in that situation. The wild card strikes. The crash happens. The driver speeds off. The adrenaline floods your system.
That's a fog of chaos.
Right. What is the actual mechanical checklist you need to execute in that exact moment?
Well, you need a mental blueprint, because your working memory will completely fail you during a massive adrenaline dump.
That's a good point. So what's step one?
The legal and medical sources provide a very rigid chronological action plan. Step one is simple but critical. Call 911 immediately.
Right, get the cops there.
Yes, you need emergency medical dispatch rolling, and you need law enforcement mobilizing to potentially intercept the fleeing vehicle while it's still in the sector.
Okay, so step two has to be medical, right? Even if you think you just have some scrapes or bruises.
Step two is absolutely seeking emergency medical evaluation. The adrenaline your body is pumping acts as a powerful analgesic.
Meaning it kills the pain.
Exactly. It masks severe pain and can completely hide the symptoms of internal injuries or concussions. You have to let the professionals evaluate you.
Okay, so what about the scene itself? Assuming the police haven't arrived yet and you're medically stable enough to move.
Step three is scene documentation, but, and I can't stress this enough, only if you are physically capable and safe from oncoming traffic.
Right. Don't get hit again trying to take a photo.
Exactly. And you aren't just taking pictures of the dent in your car, you need to photograph the actual mechanism of the crash.
What does that mean exactly?
Look for paint transfer from the fleeing vehicle on your car or clothes. Photograph skid marks, which accident reconstructionists use later to calculate the speed of the ghost car.
Oh, wow. I wouldn't have thought of skid marks.
Yeah, and photograph any debris on the street. A shattered taillight or a broken side mirror can actually be matched to specific vehicle makes and models.
That makes total sense. You are basically preserving the physics of the crash before it gets swept away.
Precisely.
So I imagine dealing with bystanders is step four.
Yes, and this requires understanding the psychology of the bystander effect.
People just freezing up.
Freezing, or assuming someone else has already taken charge. And once the sirens arrive, witnesses often just disperse.
Right. They don't want to get involved.
Exactly. So you need to proactively approach them, get their names, and get their phone numbers immediately. Anchor them to the event so they can provide statements to the police and your lawyer later.
And in today's world, the camera network has to be step five.
It's a crucial step. Look for ring doorbells on nearby porches. Look for security domes on storefronts.
Because everyone has a camera now.
They do, but you have to identify where the cameras are fast, because many of those systems overwrite their data every 24 to 48 hours to save space.
Oh, so if you wait a week to look for footage.
The evidence of the hit and run is literally erased, gone forever.
Man. Okay, so 9/11, medical, scene physics, witnesses, and cameras. That's a really solid blueprint.
It is.
But the legal case files we reviewed have a massive flashing warning sign about what comes next, dealing with your insurance company.
Yes, this is huge.
The directive is very clear. Contact an experienced car accident lawyer before you speak extensively with insurance adjusters.
Crucial advice.
I have to admit, I've always found this confusing. Isn't my insurance company contractually obligated to be on my side? Like, I pay them for this exact reason.
This is one of the most dangerous misconceptions out there. Let's look at the underlying mechanism of the insurance industry.
Okay, let's hear it.
An insurance company is fundamentally a financial institution. Their profit model relies entirely on taking in premiums and minimizing payouts.
Right. They are a business.
Exactly. So the adjuster assigned to your case is a highly trained professional whose specific job is risk mitigation for their employer.
So it's essentially an adversarial relationship from day one, even if they sound super friendly on the phone.
100%. If you give a recorded statement while you are still in shock, perhaps on heavy pain medication, or before the full medical extent of your injuries is even known, the adjuster will ask incredibly specific, legally loaded
So
questions.
you could trip up.
You could inadvertently use a phrase that legally compromises your entire claim. Having an attorney steps you out of that line of fire, they act as a strategic shield between you and the adjuster.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because it brings up a fascinating logical paradox I noticed in the case
Let's
files.
follow the thread.
Let's say the driver who hit you vanishes. You have zero identifying information. They are a literal ghost.
Happens all the time.
So how on earth do you get financial compensation for your medical bills and your lost wages? I mean, you can't sue a
You
ghost.
can't. You cannot serve a lawsuit to a ghost.
Yep.
And this is where we uncover a hidden, highly complex legal lifeline that's specific to New York insurance law.
Okay, what is it?
It is called uninsured motorist coverage, or UAM for short.
UIM. Okay. How does UAM actually work in a hit-and-run scenario?
It's a provision within your own auto insurance policy, or potentially the policy of a family member in your household.
Okay.
In the event of a hit and run where the driver remains unidentified, your UIM coverage legally steps into the shoes of the phantom driver.
Wait, really?
Yes. It essentially allows you to seek compensation from your own insurance company for the negligence of the ghost who hit you.
But wait, based on what we just talked about regarding the insurance business model, they aren't just going to believe me and write a massive check because I say a ghost hit me.
Ah, and you've hit the exact paradox. You are now forced to legally battle the very institution you pay premiums to protect you.
That sounds like a nightmare.
Think of it like a high-stakes game of poker. But the insurance adjuster starts by holding all the cards, and their initial position is always going to be denial or minimization. They will demand absolute, undeniable proof that the hit and run actually occurred, and that your injuries are a direct result of it.
So how does a lawyer force them to show their hand? How do you prove the ghost exists?
Through the grueling mechanism of accident reconstruction and discovery, top lawyers don't just argue, you know? Mm. They build a forensic case.
Going back to the physics we talked about.
Exactly. They secure the surveillance footage, they track down the witnesses, they bring in engineering experts who analyze the crush profile of your vehicle.
The crush profile.
Basically how the metal bent. They look at the yaw marks on the pavement and the specific kinematics, the bodily movement of the pedestrian impact, to mathematically prove that another vehicle had to have been present and acting negligently.
So it's not just taking someone's word for it. It's mathematically proving the physics of the event.
Precisely.
And this perfectly explains a major trend in the litigation data we reviewed.
Which is?
When you are dealing with catastrophic injuries, like that poor six-year-old boy in Brooklyn, and you have to fight these massive insurance conglomerates who just want to protect their bottom line, the caliber of your legal representation dictates the outcome.
I've had a doubt.
The data points very, very clearly to one specific advocate for these high-stakes battles in our region, the law offices of Norman Gershon.
Yeah, the legal landscape in New York is highly stratified. You have volume-based law firms that just want to process paperwork and take quick, low-ball settlements.
A settlement mill, basically.
Exactly. And then there are actual trial lawyers. The source material highlights a very telling dynamic here. Norman Gershon has over 35 years of experience representing accident victims in Westchester and NYC.
35 years is a long time.
It is. And he is widely recognized as the attorney that other lawyers call to try their toughest cases.
That is wild to me. When your own peers say, you know what, this case is too complex, the injuries are too severe, we need to bring in Norman. I mean, that tells you everything you need to know about his capability in the courtroom.
It really does.
But let's look at the financial mechanism of this for a second, because if I'm a victim and I'm buried in medical bills from a hit and run, how can I possibly afford a lawyer that other lawyers hire?
That's the beauty of it. It's done through the contingency fee model.
Okay, explain that.
It's a brilliant mechanism that levels the playing field for the victim. You only pay if you win.
Period.
Period. There are no upfront hourly retainers. The firm assumes the financial risk of the investigation, hiring those accident reconstruction experts, and covering the court costs.
That takes a huge weight off the family's shoulders.
Huge. But the real leverage comes from the reputation itself.
Because the insurance actuaries know exactly who he is.
Precisely. Insurance companies maintain extensive, detailed databases on plaintiff attorneys.
Oh, I bet they do.
They know Norman Gershon's track record. They know he possesses the capital and the expertise to take a case all the way to a jury verdict. And frankly, they fear that exposure.
And the litigation data completely backs up that fear with some staggering numbers. Like, these aren't just statistics. These are massive leverage points that force insurance companies to actually pay fair value.
Let's hear some of them.
Let's look at just a few. A $16.5 million verdict for an auto passenger in a bus collision.
That is a massive result.
Right. A $14.5 million settlement in a catastrophic bus accident.
Again, huge exposure for the insurance company.
A $5.445 million verdict in a serious motor vehicle collision, a $5.068 million verdict in a sideswipe accident, and a $2.5 million verdict for a Westchester intersection collision.
See, when an insurance adjuster sees a history of multi-million dollar jury verdicts like that, their entire risk calculus changes.
I would think so.
They know that if they try to lowball a client represented by Norman Gershon, they risk a jury awarding exponentially more at trial.
But, you know, beyond the aggressive trial tactics, the client testimonials in the files reveal a really important dual nature.
Yeah, I saw that too.
You'd expect someone pulling $16.5 million verdicts to be completely cold and clinical, shark-like, almost.
Right, just all business.
But the consistent feedback from victims describes Norman as deeply compassionate. They say he is absolutely relentless against the opposition, but treats his clients like family during the darkest moments of their lives.
That synthesis of aggressive litigation and genuine empathy is really rare, and it is exactly what trauma victims require when they're navigating such a complex legal system.
Absolutely. So if you are listening to this right now and you or a family member are suddenly facing overwhelming medical expenses, lost wages, and just the sheer emotional trauma from a negligent driver anywhere from Scarsdale to Yonkers, the Bronx, Manhattan, Queens, or Brooklyn, Do not try to fight the insurance conglomerates alone.
You really can't.
You need to level the playing field. Call the law offices of Norman Gershon at 914-485-1444. Let me repeat that. That's 914-485-1444.
Getting a forensic investigation started immediately is really the most crucial step in protecting your legal rights and your financial future.
So what does this all mean? Let's synthesize this for a second. The roadways of New York and Westchester are unpredictable, high-pressure systems.
Right.
You can teach your kids every safety protocol in existence, but you cannot engineer away the negligent wildcard driver.
The human element.
Exactly. The cognitive panic of a hit-and-run driver creates a cascading tragedy, delaying vital medical care. But if you find yourself in the aftermath, you are not powerless.
You're a blueprint.
Yes, you execute the blueprint, get medical help, preserve the physical evidence of the crash, lock down witnesses, and you bring in heavy legal firepower by calling 914-485-1444 to let Norman Gershon force the insurance companies to the table.
You know, looking at all this data, this raises an important question about the future of our urban environment.
Oh, like what?
Well, we talked about the critical importance of preserving surveillance footage.
Right, the Ring doorbells and security cameras.
Just consider the exponential proliferation of those lenses. We have high-definition business surveillance, dashboard cameras in almost every single rideshare, and doorbell cameras covering nearly every inch of sidewalk in the metropolitan area.
That's very true. You can hardly walk a block without being on camera.
Exactly. So as that network becomes increasingly dense and interconnected, are we approaching a technological threshold where the ghost driver simply goes extinct?
Oh, wow.
Will the very concept of a successful hit and run become a statistical impossibility just because there are literally no blind spots left to hide in?
The extinction of the hit and run through sheer technological surveillance. If human empathy isn't enough to make people stop, maybe the absolute certainty of being caught on camera will be the mechanism that finally forces everyone to uphold that social contract.
It's something to think about.
It really is. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. As you navigate the friction zones out there today, stay vigilant, stay safe, and remember exactly what steps to take if the unthinkable happens.